to the Development Policy Centre podcast. For the sixth edition of our Aid Budget Breakfast, we have expanded our analysis to include not only analysis of the Australian aid budget, but also aid trends in Australia and overseas. Following the eighth straight year of aid cuts, listen on to find out how we compare to other countries, where the money is going, and more.
Welcome to the 2018 Aid Budget Breakfast. Thanks for coming along. My name is Ashley Bettridge. I'm the manager at the Development Policy Centre, and this is the sixth year we've held this event, so it's great to see the continued interest. I'd like to thank everyone who's come along today, and also to those joining us on the live stream this morning. If you'd like to join the conversation on Twitter, do use the hashtag AidBudget2018. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today and to pay our respects to the elders of the Ngunnawal people, past and present. Before we dive into the nitty-gritty and unleash all of our charts, I'd just like to let you know about a few of the upcoming events and initiatives we have going on at the centre while we have a captive audience. So firstly, hot off the press, we have our 2017 annual report, which is available outside today. You can also grab a copy off our website if you prefer it in soft copy. So do have a look what we got up to. This week we've also just confirmed the date and the speaker for our 2018 Mitchell Oration. It's the sixth in our annual series. So Sir Richard Feacham will be speaking on the topic of re-engineering the aid industry, a priority for the 21st century, on Thursday, 28th of June. So do save the date and we'll have more details online. Speaking of flagship events, we have also set the dates for the 2019 Australasian Aid Conference, even though it feels like it just happened. And we'll be issuing a call for papers and for panels soon. We'll also be taking sponsors again this year. So if you are interested in coming on board, do get in touch with me and we can discuss the options. We're also embarking on our next series of aid profiles, which will form the shortlist for the 2019 Mitchell Humanitarian Award, which we'll be presenting at the Aid Conference next year. You can see our past nominees up here on the screen, and we'd encourage you to read their stories if you haven't already. But if you do know someone whose story deserves to be told as part of this series, please do get in touch with us because we'd love to hear from you. We're also about to embark on our next Australian Aid Stakeholder Survey. So we'll have information coming out on that soon. We really value your participation in this and it provides really useful information on the state of the sector. So do keep an eye out when we launch the various phases of the survey. Also, we have two great PNG-related events coming up this month. Next week, we've got the screening of the PNG-made film Alico and Ambai and a Q&A with the assistant producer, Teresa Mecki. And on May 30, we have a PNG evaluation forum discussing three recent PNG aid evaluations. So, I'm about to free you from this barrage of announcements, but before I hand over to Stephen, I just want to say that when it comes to the type of work that you see today, our analysis on Australian aid, we do need to maintain independence so we can be as frank as we need to be. So we are asking that if you do support the work that we do and are able to, if you could please consider making a donation. We tried not to ask often, but we do need financial support. So we are asking you now, and we're very grateful to anyone who feels compelled to maybe chip in just a little bit to help us continue the work that we do on Australian Aid. But now it's time to move on to the main show, which is what everyone's here for. This year we've changed the format up a bit and we've decided to broaden the scope beyond the budget and share some of our wider analysis with you. So now I'm going to hand over to our Centre Director, Stephen House, who'll give you the lowdown on the aid budget and much, much more. Please welcome Stephen.
All right, thanks a lot, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. As Ashley mentioned, we felt the format, while useful, had perhaps got a little stale. The aid budget's become a little bit predictable, and so we have broadened out this event to give a wider review. So the cost for that is you have to put up with a lecture from me. I've got lots of slides, and we'll see how far we get through. But let's dive straight into it. This is what I'm going to talk about, and then if we have time, I'm going to talk go beyond the official aid program and beyond Australia to look at the international, other partners in the international scene. Let's start first with the budget that was handed down last night and the broader budget context. So I think it's fair to say that public policy has been dominated by the deficit that came into being at the time of the great financial crisis. But that problem is now shrinking. And, you know, while it's always been projected to shrink, the difference this year is these are, actuals or estimates. It actually has shrunk already, and it's already gone away. And, in fact, the budget is meant to return to a small surplus next year. So that's on the back largely of increases in revenue, and revenue has already started to rebound and is projected to continue. That in turn is on the back of improved commodity prices and stronger than expected employment growth. It may all go wrong again and these rosy projections not come to fruition, but even if it does, you know, the deficit I think is already so small that that whole narrative of debt and deficit that had already pretty much faded away, I think has now been almost obliterated. While the deficit elimination is driven by strong revenue performance, it's important to note that's in the context of strong expenditure growth. So this is not a deficit problem that's been addressed by austerity. Indeed, if you were to look at this graph and try and work out how Australia solved its deficit problem, you would say, well, revenue fell away at the time of the financial crisis and it took a while for it to catch up. And expenditure growth, you know, expenditures has kept on growing. And that's, you know, not a bad simplification of the underlying, much more complex reality. All right, that's the overall budgetary context within which the aid budget is positioned. And normally we dive straight into the aid budget numbers. But this year there was a slight complication because we had some retrospective adjustments. And we need to understand those first of all, they're important in themselves, but also in order to be able to understand the budget numbers, you've got to understand what are now the historical numbers. So you can see for the last 3 years, there are some fairly significant aid increases of, you know, some almost $200 million for each of the 3 years. So what explains this this fit of retrospective generosity? It's really the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. Australia joined the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank in 2015, and the price tag for that was $930 million over 5 years, starting in 2016. At the time, we wrote in blogs and in submissions, I mean, we commented on the price tag, which seemed to us fairly high, but we also said that it would be ODA eligible. Treasury and DFAT took another position that Australia's paid-in capital will not be provided from the aid budget. In the end, it turns out we were right, or at least 85% right, because 85% of it is being charged to the aid budget. It's only been officially confirmed by DAC recently. That's the government's rationale for taking this somewhat confusing approach. I think you could have taken a much more transparent approach. It was always obvious from the start it would be ODA eligible. The good news is that this sort of approach has meant that the AIIB cost has come on top of the existing aid budget because you can't have retrospective aid cuts. So I guess if you look at it from an aid budget, protecting the aid budget point of view, it's a strategy that has worked. But that explains the need for the retrospective adjustments, as well as two more are needed, right? We've had three, we need two more. So with that context, you can now understand what actually happened in the budget. Of course, there were all these rumours and denials of cuts, but if we actually look at what happened, it's fairly simple. You can make a fairly simple comparison with what was put in the forward estimates last year. So this year and next is increased by about 160 to 170 each year to pay for the AIIB. Then on top of that, this year and the next two, so what were the three forward estimates years, are otherwise reduced by $10 million. It's a small amount, but somehow this government can't resist just taking out these small amounts from the aid program. And then what was a two-year freeze to be followed by a resumption of CPI indexation has now been extended by a third year. So the nominal aid freeze extended to the new forward estimates year of 21-22. It's now, according to the budget papers, to be lifted the following year. So outside the forward estimates, and we'll see whether that happens. So this is the new aid trajectory under the coalition, just in nominal terms, slightly different to the old. The red is the last year of the Labor government. That's also been adjusted for reasons I haven't quite got to the bottom of yet, maybe to do with refugee costs. So in fact, we see a slight increase now in the first 2 years of the coalition, but then we see the cuts, and you end up pretty much where we were before. So some micro level changes, but if you look at the big picture, it's pretty much unchanged. We've always said that the coalition is cutting aid by a third once you take account inflation, and the number now comes out at 32%, right? Which is this number here. So slightly lower base because of the reduction in that labor last year of labor. But then an additional year of the cuts, so the final position is almost unchanged. And if we put that into the longer term historical perspective, this is the graph we've shown before. We've now extended it by another 10 years back to the 60s, but you see a period of gradual increase, the massive scale up, and then the significant reversal of the scale up. I'd say the difference is that we used to think that there was kind of a reversal of the scale up and then aid would continue, go back on a trajectory of slow increases. That seems like a little optimistic. Now, we still have an aid budget, kind of in free fall. It's maybe the fall is slightly less steep, but it's still heading south. And I guess that's the question, how long will the aid program continue to fall? We can't be as sanguine that we're back on a stable or increasing trajectory after a series of cuts. In fact, we are still in the midst of those cuts to aid. This is, if you look at it on a year-on-year basis and adjust for inflation, we're in a sea of red. Right? These are the ongoing aid cuts. And in fact, there are eight of these. That's what we blogged about last night. We were just struck that there are now, we have 8 years of aid cuts in a row, some much bigger than others, but nevertheless eight in a row. And we've never seen anything like it before, either in terms of magnitude of the cuts or in terms of the number of cuts. Most governments cut aid for a couple of years, 1 or 2 years when they're facing a difficult time. But this government has just kept on cutting. And if we look at the implications of that for our generosity, this ODA to GNI ratio, it's at an all-time low and falling. I guess that hasn't changed. But that 0.2, we were already at a record low. The 0.2 sort of threshold is now just a couple of years away. We're going to hit that in 2020 and continue falling. I want to put this now in the international context. It's a fairly gloomy picture, and it's important to realise this is not symptomatic of some broader international malaise when it comes to aid. It's all too easy to think, that aid is something old-fashioned and the whole world is moving on from it. No, the whole world, well, we can't say the whole world, but in general, the world is embracing aid. Aid is at a record high and has continued to increase and indeed increase strongly. There's a slight reduction in this very last year, but overall the trend is strongly positive. And that is reflected in the global ODA to GNI index. So there are two ways to calculate that index. One is weighted and one is unweighted. The weighted is the total, the unweighted is the average. And if you weight it, right, you do see this sort of long-term decline. It has now stabilised, even that one's picked up. And that really reflects the US, right? The story of aid is the US is the blue, right? The US started big and has basically stayed the same. The rest of the world started small. The rest of the OECD started small and has increased. So you see this early decline in the blue line, the weighted average, but that's stabilised. And for the orange line, it's actually, almost at a record high. So You can also see it this way. If you think of that 0.7 target, very easy to think that that target's out of date. It's totally irrelevant. But in fact, if you look at the number of countries that are achieving the 0.7 target, it's the blue. Again, it's at a record high. There are four of them this year, and there are a couple just below the 0.7. Right. So, and the orange shows 0.5 to 0.7, and a 0.5 was a target Australia once aspired to achieve. And again, that's there are another three or four countries at that level. So yeah, I just want to underline that point that what we're seeing in Australia is not symptomatic of a broader. The rest of the world's going in a different direction. And you know, the cynic might say, well, this is all about paying the cost of in-country refugee processing and entry, but it's not. That is one factor, and it is ODA eligible, the first year of in-country refugee-related expenditure. And, you know, it's a very legitimate and productive use of development assistance. But it's relatively small. It has increased, which is, it's the blue. But even if you take out the blue, you don't agree with that, you just look at the red, you'll still see strong growth in development assistance. So if you put those two conflicting trends together, the rest of the world becoming more generous, Australia becoming less, of course, it's not surprising that our global ranking is plummeting. We're now, well, this one doesn't show the ranking. This just compares the ratios. We never got to the unweighted average. We got close when we were scaling up, but we're now below even the weighted average, and significantly below. Below by more than we've ever been. And that's because, you know, the two are going in different directions, right? We're getting richer. You know, as a country, we're becoming more prosperous. That's the blue line. But as a nation, we're becoming less generous. That's the green line. And, you know, just to drive this point home, you can rank Australia by our prosperity and by our generosity. And in terms of prosperity, that's the affluence, what I call the affluence rank, the orange line. So we're here, we're ninth. We're the ninth most affluent OECD country. But in terms of our generosity, here's our ranking. We're now the 19th most generous. So the difference between those two, you know, what I call the generosity deficit. So 19 minus 9 is 10. So our generosity deficit has never been higher than it is currently. And as I mentioned, in a couple of years, we're going to be joining the 0.2% club, which is the group of OECD donors who give 0.2% or less in aid, and it's not really a club you want to be a member of. The US is a member of that club, and, you know, if we were the largest aid donor in the world, perhaps you might think, okay, well, it's not so, you know, that's a compensating factor, but we're not the largest donor in the world. And the other members of that club have a per capita income much lower than us, at least 10,000 lower, and they're either former aid recipients, like Korea or Greece, and or they're coming out of a severe economic and fiscal crisis, Spain, Portugal, Greece, or they are, you know, economies in transition, new joinees of the OECD. But this is the club we're going to be joining in just a couple of years. So why have we decided to buck the global trend and be so savage with our aid budget? As you all know, the old rationale for aid cuts has been the debt and the deficit. And this has been reflected in Julie Bishop's comments and was picked up by the DAC review in its review of the aid program. But this rationale, you know, doesn't really make a lot of sense because, as I mentioned, the fiscal position is improving. You know, we should have seen some respite for aid if that really was the rationale. And as you can see from this graph, you know, and as I mentioned, consistent with what I mentioned before, non-aid growth has actually been growing pretty strongly, right? It's 31% under the coalition, adjusted for inflation, and here's that 32% cut. For aid. So it's not really fiscal austerity, it's more that aid is simply much further down the priority list. And if you look at the spending on ODA to total expenditure, you know, it's been on a downward trajectory throughout the coalition period, and it's now down at under well under 1%, well under 1 cent in the dollar. And I just particularly want to focus on the defence aid comparison. Some of you will remember in the days when aid was being scaled up, there was a lot of criticism that aid was being scaled up at the neglect of defence, and that this was very bad from a national security point of view. Well, that's certainly no longer the case. And in fact, it's quite remarkable that the ratio of defence spending to aid spending has already increased by such a large extent, from about $5 for every $1 of aid, $5 of defence. It's already gone up to about $8, and over the forward estimates, it's going to go up to $11 of defence for every $1 of aid, higher than it's ever been, including during the Cold War. And given that Australia doesn't actually face any military threats, you really question the efficiency or effectiveness of this type of government decision-making. I think it would be very hard to justify this high level of defence spending. But anyway, all that stuff on fiscal austerity seems to be on the back burner. There's now a new rationale for cutting aid, which is the lack of public support. And if you've listened to recent speeches, or you can see this YouTube interview with the Minister for International Development, you'll see she very much casts the aid budget in terms of lack of public support rather than the fiscal position. So just to run through some of what she's been saying in explaining why aid is so low. 80% of Australians think we're spending just enough or too much on ODA. And she's been citing Lowy polling on this, and sure enough, Lowy polling does show that about 80% are in the too much or about right category. Of course, it doesn't explain why you'd cut aid, because if you want to follow public opinion, you've also got a majority here who wouldn't support cutting aid. But that's the first point she's been making. Second one, drawing on some research that we've done, and Terence Wood in particular, 80% of the development sector believe we should spend more on ODA, but only 10% of regular Australians think the same. So yes, welcome to all the irregular Australians who might be here, and indeed non-Australians. But that's also, roughly true. Here you see the big difference between those in the polled in the development sector and the general community. I think where the minister goes wrong is to get in terms of her response to this and what she's going to do to build public support. She says the only way Australians have confidence in the aid program is to understand that we'll have a direct benefit to Australia. Whereas, in fact, Terence has polled Australians on precisely this point, and you can see that only 4% think that are going to be motivated by the argument that aid has direct benefits to Australia. The great majority are more persuaded by arguments around it being a moral obligation or around enlightened national interests. So as a strategy to build public support, it doesn't seem to have a lot going for it. So where are the glimmers of hope that these aid cuts will at some point come to an end under the current government? We'll talk about Labor policy later. It's hard to be hopeful, but I guess the China factor is one that is certainly bolstering aid in the Pacific and may have a broader effect. And then the whole loss of international influence status hasn't seemed to have had worked so far, but when we are actually going to join this 0.2% club, it may swing into action. But overall, a fairly bleak outlook. All right, moving on from the overall aid quantities to what was in the budget in terms of allocations and initiatives, let's look at countries and sectors. I think this was a budget for the Pacific. This is the AusAid DFAT allocations, which are not as comprehensive as the total aid flows, but do kind of reveal government intentions. And you can see that over the coalition period, the Pacific has largely been protected. And in this budget in particular, the Pacific receives a boost in its aid allocation and is the only region to do so. East Asia, has had cuts and then has now had further cuts in its aid, and other regions are pretty much constant. So this is a budget that was consistent with earlier government priorities, but which takes them further in terms of prioritising the Pacific over East Asia and the rest of the world. And we'll come to the initiatives behind that next. In terms of sectors, I think you can also say this is a budget that's consistent with broader policies and continues earlier trends. These are my estimates of where the various budgets with the adjustments for the AIIB have come out. And you can see that infrastructure continues to increase, agriculture continues to increase, governance is steady, and education and health are cut once again. I think this is consistent with the government's policy. It's got an aid for trade target. I think perhaps what's surprising is the government, has overachieved that aid for trade target. It's now 23%. You had thought perhaps there was a rebalancing with the health security initiative, that there was going to be some stop to those, especially the cuts to health, given that you've got a flagship initiative on health security. But I guess, this is a ship that takes a long time to turn around, and priority is firmly set on aid for trade. So infrastructure and agriculture continue to grow at the expense of the other sectors. I'm going to skip this. Humanitarian funding is increased. That's part of the white paper announcement. I've just put in a question mark there because it was meant to increase last year and didn't actually. And it'd just be worth finding out a bit more about that. Perhaps there weren't the rapid onset disasters to exhaust the money allocated last year. At the same time, you think there's so many chronic crises that if you have it's hard to believe how your humanitarian allocation could be underutilised. So I guess there's a promise to increase the humanitarian allocation, but on last year's experience, you couldn't say that promise will necessarily be delivered on. Looking more at other aspects of the aid program, it's just interesting to think of other government departments. It used to be a big part of aid, really not anymore, apart from ACR, which continues to grow. You see other government departments exiting development. I've taken out the AIIB allocations, which go through Treasury, because we're really interested here in actual departmental participation, through sending advisors and twinning programs and so on. Certainly no longer a priority. Right, that's broadly on the allocations. Just some of the major initiatives underlying those numbers. So the underwater cable to Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea. This is probably the biggest initiative in the budget. It had already been announced, but for the first time, there are allocations. It's still unclear what the allocation is, and the government says it's because it's being tendered out, so it's commercial in confidence. But there was a newspaper report that it was $200 million. And if you look at the actual increase to Solomon Islands and PNG, which is driving the increase to the Pacific, it's an increase of $100 million. And so that kind of makes sense. It's a pretty quick project. I think it only take 2 years to lay the cable. So $200 million. Of course, we were told not to conclude anything from the increase in PNG and Solomons, but if you do make that calculation, it all seems to add up. This is funded by cuts to Indonesia, $30 million. I guess Indonesia is singled out as the largest aid program outside of the Pacific and so vulnerable to aid graduation talk. And then, the rest of the program is held flat in nominal terms, so it's cut in real terms, and then there is a small nominal increase in this budget, almost in line with inflation, which then funds the underwater cable. Of course, there are lots of debates about the cable, whether it should be part of the aid program or not. We can debate those, but I think regardless of that, there are certainly big issues around co-financing, which is expected from the governments. These governments are both in fiscal stress. PNG struggles to pay its salaries. It's not clear how they'll get the money for their co-financing contribution. And then how the cable will be governed, what the open access arrangements will be, are also unclear. And I can anticipate these two problems being quite thorny going forward. Second big initiative is health security. This wasn't a budget initiative, but it was announced late last year, and it certainly features in the budget. This is a very large program. It's equal in size to the eighth largest bilateral program. They've just announced PDP funding, which is medical for global medical research, which continues on and increases, you know, what's now become an established patent or established program of support from the Australian Aid Program. That's very welcome, I think. And yeah, just to say, we continue to make the, to support this initiative, but to make the case for a separate international health research organisation or to broaden ACR's mandate. And then finally, I thought, you know, what was really positive in the budget was the emphasis on labour mobility. You also see this in the numbers. There's, apart from the PNG and Solomon Islands increase, there's an increase in Pacific Regional. That's for a number of regional initiatives. There's also a Pacific Security College. There's a schools twinning program. But there's also support for both the APTC for training with a specific mandate to train for international markets and the Pacific Labour Facility. I think this is terrific. It's the biggest dividend from the DFAT-AusAid integration. You know, I think in the old days, DFAT saw the Pacific as AusAid's responsibility, and AusAid saw the Pacific through an aid lens. Now they're together, and DFAT's rather sceptical of what aid can achieve. You've had this confluence of promotion of labour mobility with the government, you know, expanding the seasonal worker program, introducing the Pacific Labour Scheme, expansion of labour mobility, but then now the mobilisation of the aid program to support labour mobility. So, you know, what we call aid for migration as against aid for trade. And it is delivering serious money to the Pacific direct to households. So if you believe in cash transfers, you'll like what this is doing. This is just from the World Bank report. If you compare the income that workers are bringing home from the seasonal worker program with the money their governments are getting through the aid program, in Tonga it's the same, right? In Vanuatu, still a long way to go, but Vanuatu is participation is growing rapidly. And, you know, this is direct to households, right? Doesn't have all the waste of aid programs. And, you know, this is also, in fact, a benefit to Australia. I mean, the aid program, however much we might like it, it is a cost. Whereas this SWP income comes actually at a benefit to the Australian economy. Okay, moving on to aid performance. You know, do feel free to interrupt. I know I'm just rabbiting on. Government also just released last week the new aid performance report, Performance of Australian Aid 2016-17, which has a whole a raft of information around various performance aspects of the program. I won't summarise it for you, except to say that nearly all the performance benchmarks, all the 10, are either achieved or very nearly achieved. We'll just share with you a little bit of the analysis that we've done. We do this every year. Each country is ranked for performance against program objectives and whether they're on track to achieve the objectives. And this is the data for the last 4 years. And, you know, I just want to point out how unusual it is to get a rating of less than 50%, and how if you do get a rating of less than 50%, you invariably bounce back the next year. So kind of the message is sent, this is unacceptable, we need to lift our game, and performance bounces back up above 50%. Sadly, PNG is the exception, you know, that sort of proves this rule. PNG is languishing at the bottom of the performance table. It does show some slight improvement over the years, but still well below 50%. And I guess that does just highlight what a difficult environment Papua New Guinea presents for the Australian Aid Program. And, you know, it's not to pick on PNG, but it is our closest neighbour and the largest recipient of Australian aid. So it's certainly significant. It also gives a perspective on the shift away from Indonesia, which is up here. So, you know, it's actually got 100% at the moment, 100% score for program objectives on track. So it's taking funding from
what is one of our best performing aid programs to what is our worst performing aid program. Just want to say a word on transparency, since it's a subject that we often write about. There's clearly been a deterioration in transparency at the project level over the last few years, and this has both been shown by the two audits that we've done and by the perception, or is confirmed by the perception of stakeholders in the two stakeholder surveys that we've undertaken. And it's, you know, also consistent with, and it was good to see the DAC review, the OECD review of Australian aid, come up with transparency as their number one recommendation, their first recommendation that DFAT should improve its transparency in relation to the timely and accessible publication of activity level information. And I mention this because the this new performance report signals that the government will be coming up with a new set of performance indicators. Right? Those 10 have been achieved or largely achieved, so it's seen as time to refresh them. That's a process that's underway, so I encourage everyone to get involved in that process. But I think a real litmus test for the credibility of that process will be whether there is one of the 10 new benchmarks is for transparency at the project level. And then finally on performance, just one of the numbers we crunched thought was interesting was this the admin ratio, or the sort of the running costs of the aid program. They're at just around 7%, and they seem rather high by historical standards, especially given all the talk of we don't have the skills and we're contracting everything out to facilities. Unclear why the admin ratio is at that level. Just briefly, the government announced a 5% cap, but sort of abandoned that almost immediately. Anyway, I just flagged this as something worthy of more research. Well, that's all about government policy. I think we should say a word about Labor. So enough of the blue, time for some red. What's Labor been saying on aid and these various issues? Prior to the last election, Labor committed an additional $800 million over the forward estimates, or $200 million a year, so about 5% as an increase. This year, so far, they've made a much weaker commitment, which is simply to provide more ODA than the coalition. But, that could be a token amount. It may be that a more concrete announcement will come closer to the election, but so far, it's still very vague, and indeed, you can not as clear as it was in the run-up to the last election. In terms of position of Labor on aid policy, many of you would have heard Penny Wong speak at the Australasian Aid and International Development Conference. She made several points, I thought. One, basically signalling she would abolish the Innovation Exchange. She said she was unconvinced by it, that it operated in relative isolation. Second, she would reform the Health Security Initiative. While she supported it, she said it was bureaucratic and disconnected. And I think it can certainly be better structured, as we said, outside of DFAT. And then she spoke generally on the need for DFAT reform, highlighting structural inadequacies, management failings, growing dependence on management contractors, expertise and skills in decline. So certainly a lot more on aid policy from Labor so far than on aid quantity. Okay, now we want to go, as I said, beyond the official aid program and look at, who's delivering Australian aid, the delivery partners. So this is the graph that summarises it. This data, is very hard to get on a comparable basis, and we've tried different ways. This is sort of the latest, just for 4 years, and using the categories of multilateral, commercial, or contractors, NGOs, universities, and developing countries. There are some other categories that are harder to interpret. And I want to talk about the first three, which are the biggest. But I'll just note, you do see this decline here, very sharp decline in developing country recipient executed projects, which reflects a move away from budget support. But I'm going to focus on the first three, which are the biggest. I'm going to start with non-government organisations. And I do that because You know, we've just done, Terence Wood, one of our researchers, has just helped ACFID write their State of the Sector report, which is a new report now available on their website. I think it gets the award for having the most boring cover, which is...
the website's coming.
Which should I put Terence's photo up there just to make the slide look better. Anyway, I'm not going to summarise that report. It has a wealth of information in it. I commend it to you. I'm just going to highlight a few things that come out from it combined with some of the other research we've been doing. If we look at NGO funding, it's a pretty positive picture overall, and you certainly don't see any scale down. This is in constant dollars, so adjusted for inflation. And, 2000, 2001 is $400 million. Today, it's $1.8 billion, right? That's almost half the size of the official aid program. Of course, there's some overlap. That's, you know, relatively small amount comes from the official aid program. But, it's a massive and rapidly growing sector. This is non-DFAT other. So this is a use of Australian NGOs by other international NGOs or by other governments or other UN agencies, and it'd be interesting to find out more about this. It itself is growing rapidly. DFAT funding is less positive, and in fact, has seen that decline. That comes from the first graph. Although this data, which comes from DFAT, shows more of a decline than this data that comes from the NGOs. Right, here's a smaller decline, and that may reflect that some of the cuts that DFAT reports is because DFAT's giving it to the contractors, right? But then the contractors are then handing it on to the NGOs. So the NGOs are reporting it as from DFAT, whereas from DFAT it's actually going to the contractors. So this may exaggerate the cuts in funding to NGOs. There's still been reduction, but it may be smaller, as suggested by this graph. The biggest source of funding for the NGOs is from the public, and this is the picture for public donations, and I think you can look at this in a positive or negative light, depending on your mood. In a positive light, if you adjust for inflation, again, a massive increase from 200 million at the start of the millennium, or 200, maybe just less than 300, up to a billion. So that's a tripling. The less positive spin... Oh, sorry, that's not inflation. Inflation adjusted is 400 to a billion, right, over the last 15 years. I guess the less negative spin is on the more recent past, right? We saw a big spike with the Asian tsunami, and those donors were, you know, some of them were lost, but they were retained, others were retained or recaptured. But the growth has certainly slowed down in recent years and now seems to fluctuate depending on, you know, whether there's a large humanitarian appeal or not. If we look at it, you know, using the same sort of metrics we do for official aid as a percentage of GNI or per capita, for the decade as a whole, a significant increase, but for the last 4 or 5 years, flatlining, and it's about $40 a person is the average NGO donation. So I'd say for the more recent period, public generosity is steady rather than growing. One concern we've had is that NGOs have been cannibalising each other's donations and resulting in a kind of an arms race and increasing spend on fundraising without an increasing return. But if we combined what Terence has done with some earlier work we did, they're not quite comparable, but the suggestion is the fundraising ratios have stabilised rather than increased. So I think that's a good sign. And if we go down to the individual level, who are the big NGOs? World Vision still dominates, right? This is truncated. Right, if we had World Vision, we have to go up to 348. Everyone else would seem rather small, so I've truncated the graph. But there are some interesting other members of the top 20, MSF and Compassion, neither of them members of ACFID. Fred Hollows, I'll show you soon, are growing rapidly. And then MAA, which I had to look up, which is Muslim Aid Australia, which has propelled itself into the top 20. And there's another, Islamic Relief, I think, another, which is just outside the top 20. So we're certainly seeing some new entrants. You'll also notice the two UN agencies, UNHCR and UNICEF, that have been both very successful in fundraising. It is a very competitive environment and one with a lot of churn. So just to give you that perspective, this figure only looks at the top 10. And in fact, there are nine because World Vision is one, right, or 100%. So these are ratios to World Vision, both now, or the most recent, 2016, and then the earliest data we've got is 2003. So the first thing you can see is that the other agencies are catching up to World Vision, right, where World Vision still dominates. Back in 2003, the second largest NGO, which then was Oxfam, was little more than 10% of World Vision's size, right, whereas now you've got four NGOs that are more 10% or more of World Vision size, and the largest MSF is now a quarter, right? So World Vision dominates, but other NGOs are catching up. And then you could just see some of the very differential growth. So you can see how MSF has sort of come from nowhere. Fred Hollows, likewise, has come from nowhere. The ones that don't have any red weren't in the top 10, right? So again, Australia's for UNHCR have come from nowhere, as has Global Development Group, which is another church-based NGO. So yeah, it's a very dynamic and competitive environment at the NGO level. Finally, just for those of you who aren't in the sector but might be interested in what's going on, you know, we had an interesting session at the Australasian Aid Conference, which is actually now available as a podcast, which certainly drew my attention to this debate. Oh, thank you. There's not much more to go. To this push by government, actually, to institute a joint fundraising mechanism. Australia used to have something called IDEC, which is the International Development Emergency Committee, which used to run joint appeals back in the days of Live Aid. It didn't last, and really what the push from government now is to reinstitute something like IDEC. As far as I can tell, the government's motivation, it sees it as a way to reduce fragmentation on the ground. If the aid agencies are forced to collaborate for fundraising, they'll have less of an incentive to get their own people on the ground for their own fundraising efforts. The NGOs, as far as I can tell, don't seem very keen on the idea. As I said, it is a very competitive environment. But of course, the government has a lot of leverage being a major funder of humanitarian aid. So it'll be interesting to see how this debate plays out. All right, moving on from NGOs to contractors. I don't have as much information, but we'll start with the basic data from DFAT. Here's DFAT funding of contractors. This is just in nominal terms, but you know, you can see it has increased over the last few years, right? No sign, you wouldn't know that the aid program was cut by $1 billion over these couple of years if you just looked at how the contractors were doing. So no doubt there has been more emphasis on funding through contractors. Going down to the individual level, it's harder to get that information, but you can get some. There was a useful answer to a Senate estimates question on who are the largest contractors, and this was the information provided for 2015-16. As I understand, this is sort of money expended in that year by these contractors. And, you know, you can see it's a very concentrated market. If you take the top three, it's 50%. And if you take the top six, I think you're up above 60%. And you take, these are the top nine, I think, you're up to 97%. So it's a very concentrated market. It has been disrupted by APT. There's a website called Love Me Tender, which scrapes all government tender documentation onto one website, and you can download that and sort by whatever category you want. So this is in terms of contract award, right? So this is not flow of money. This is how successful you've been in that year. And you can see in 2016-17, APT was very successful in winning a number of large contracts, and so it is sort of the emerging player. We hope, you know, to do a lot more analysis using this database and to be able to report it to you later. But just to compare the contractors and the NGOs, the contractor community is much more concentrated. Even if you just focus on DFAT funding for the NGOs, as I mentioned, top three over 50%, whereas the top three for the NGOs only 30%. And then finally, yeah, for those of you who aren't contractors, you may not know, there has been this interesting move I mean, ACFID has always been much stronger than what was the IDC, which was the contractor body, but the IDC has now been replaced by the IDCC, which is the International Development Contractors Community, and which is, was launched at the start of this year, and as I understand, is meant to be better resourced, actually have paid staff, and a more active voice in the development community. So I think that's a very welcome development. And then finally, multilaterals. I think this is the sort of real news. I think we've sort of been very focused as on the share versus the contractors versus the NGOs, that kind of battle, as it were, jostling for funding, but really not paying any attention to what is the biggest recipient of Australian aid, which is the multilateral system, you know, twice as big as the contractors. So if we're looking at contractors, we're seeing 800 million, but we're looking at multilaterals, 1.6 billion, right? It's a much bigger share, and again, it's slightly volatile, but you don't see any cut. You wouldn't think this was an aid program that was in sharp decline. So what's going on here? Well, core funding to multilaterals is on the rise, and you know, this is very surprising. This is actually was brought out by the DAC review. You know, it's always been said Australia is not a big believer in core funding. The multilaterals focus on Africa. We focus on the Asia Pacific. Why would we give core funding to the multilaterals? And then in any case, the average figure, which I show here, is biased upwards because all the European countries give to the EU. You know, and you can see this was true for this period. We were, most of the period, we have been below the average, but somehow we've hit it now. Now, this is slightly inflated because of those AIIB payments. But even so, the trend goes well beyond that. And you can actually break down that the core funding into, well, you can go right down to the agency level, but just if you look at three different types, the international development banks, the UN agencies, and other being like Global Fund, Gavi, Global Partnership on Education, all of them show an increase over the last decade. This is a five-year average, moving average, because these are very volatile numbers, but you know there is an underlying trend there, and I think particularly surprising to see the UN doing so well. You know, we can understand the pickup here to do with the UN Security Council bid and Labor, but it's certainly continued under the coalition government. So I think it'd be interesting to talk about why this is, it's certainly there. It's somewhat offset by reductions in earmark contributions. This has been traditionally the way we've given support to the system. If you look at 2011, right, the earmarked contributions exceed the core contributions because that's exactly the argument, right? We want to get these agencies to work in our region, so we give them specific funding. But I guess what's happened, you know, that a lot of that happened in Asia. You know, we've cut aid to Asia, so we've cut earmarked contributions to the multilaterals at the same time as increasing our core contributions for perhaps a range of different reasons. But the net effect is that multilateral funding is stronger than ever, which is probably an unexpected outcome. Okay, well, this is the final section. I wanted to just say, to round it off, you know, go back to the international context. I'm not going to go through every donor. I'm just going to focus on the big three plus one. So the big three are now the US, the UK, and Germany. There were five with France and Japan, but as you can see from this graph, France and Japan have somewhat fallen away, partly as a result of you know, their own changing economic priorities and difficulties, but also because these are you know, very much loan-based donors, and so they're getting a lot of inflows, reflows, right? They push down their net ODA, which is what's reported here. The US is still by far the biggest, but you can see the gap's closing. It doesn't dominate as it used to. Let's start with the US. You know, I think we were all concerned with the impact that Trump would have, and he certainly had a very negative impact with the global gag rule, which prevents agencies from receiving funding for family planning and also receiving US aid funding. But beyond that very regressive step, impact has not been negative, and in fact now looks somewhat positive. Trump administration proposed cuts of about one-third both last year and again for this year, but it was simply ignored last year by Congress that actually sets the aid budget, and it looks like it will be ignored again this year. So we're not seeing those savage cuts that we thought would come to come to fruition. And in terms of what we are seeing, there's a lot of emphasis in the Trump aid administration on what is called journeys to self-reliance, so graduation. So that's a narrative that may play out in our region on East Asia. It's now referred to as outcome one, and there are metrics to measure countries' progress to graduation, so they're used to get countries off aid. You know, whether that's good or bad, I'm not sure. But in terms of, you know, probably good things, the last two, Trump is now proposing a strengthened OPIC, which is a pre-existing small development finance institution, to be made much bigger. So I think that's, you know, a positive step, something that's been advocated for in Australia, and, you know, brings together a kind of concern for development with a belief in the private sector. So something that a good development to come out of a Republican administration. And then, interestingly, the World Bank has just agreed on a big capital expansion, and, you know, that could have been vetoed by the US, and, you know, it was thought that it would be vetoed, but in the end, the Trump administration have signed off on this capital replenishment for the World Bank, I guess driven by, you know, concerns around China as a strategic rival, and so therefore a need to bolster the World Bank. That's the US, UK and Germany. You know, we pay a lot of attention to the UK and how it went up to 0.7 and stayed at 0.7, but I think we probably haven't really noticed that Germany has sort of snuck up there unannounced and is pretty much at the 0.7 mark now, and then so being a bigger economy is actually a larger donor than the UK. For Germany, the in-country refugee costs are a significant part of that, so probably not going to stay at 0.7. In 2016, it was one quarter of its budget went to in-country refugee costs. But it's not only that. Right? If you look at the yellow, you also see a significant increase, right? So excluding the in-country refugee costs. And you've seen a big push in Germany as chair of the G20 in terms of advocating a Marshall Plan with Africa or a compact for Africa. And just on Africa, that does remind me, I was going to comment on the multilateral funding, that big increase in multilateral funding for everyone who thinks that Australia should be doing more on Africa. You know, you should be very welcoming of this increase in core funding, because their focus is Africa. Yeah, that's Germany. And then finally, UK. I think UK is a case of be careful what you wish for. UK is where what we would have looked like if we did ever get to 0.5 or anything like it. You know, I'm sure its aid program is still doing a lot of good, but it's also, it's a very troubled, divisive aid program. There's a very good article on it, which is hyperlinked here. There are constant campaigns being run against the aid program, such as this Daily Mail campaign, that charity begins at home, you know, that is begins and ends at home. And the Department for International Development is also, you know, no longer the glorious institution it once was and is having to fight for funds. You see a big increase away from funding through DFID. Its share of the aid program has fallen from 87% to 74%, whereas the other government departments have gone from 11% to 18%. So in a constrained fiscal environment, a large aid program becomes very attractive. So those are the three I was going to focus on, but as some of you will know, last night there was a big announcement coming out of New Zealand that I just couldn't, that's also important. New Zealand's announced, although it's not their budget, but just ahead of their budget, they've announced a large increase of $180 million a year for the next 4 years. It's not clear exactly where it's going to go, but a range of things are mentioned, the Pacific, multilaterals, climate change, humanitarian. And, you know, New Zealand's also been a pretty poor performer when it comes to aid generosity, but they are now, they put themselves on an upward trajectory and, you know, with some very ambitious goals. So interesting to see how that plays out, if that has any influence here. All right, well, that's the end of my presentation. I do want to point you to the aid tracker if you want to find out more. A lot of these numbers are up there. It's already been updated. And I do want to say that, you know, I presented this myself, but I've drawn on the work of a lot of colleagues, and I'd like to thank all of them for their contributions to this analysis. So thank you, and happy to take questions or comments.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea, the Pacific and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter to get all the latest updates, or you can connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.